ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan for your Friday. Hello, Teddy.
Corb, it's Friday morning.
It is. What do they say? Win the morning, win the day.
Always. I mean, what a motto. Did I see you? Are you running some kind of rival football podcast?
It's dual roles, just multifaceted okay. broadcaster that I'm trying to be. So.
And is it daily? Are you doing a daily show?
It's between Ben and I. We've got to drop most days. So almost every day.
What do football fans listen to every day?
They're hungry for the
hungry
thirsty,
for what?
Thirsty for content.
Trade rumours of 2029.
Yeah. There's 9 games a weekend. You know,
you guys have lost it.
You know, the appetite for footy is enormous. Like it's interesting. I'm sure there'll be some psychologist somewhere that'll write a thesis on it or whatever it turns out to be. Like since COVID. Whether it's the NFL or it's the EPL or the NRL or the AFL, the surge in popularity and I can't remember anticipation for a footy season as hot as it has been, you know, multiple weeks out from the season, like the last couple of years. I don't know if it's that tribalism, that sense of, you know, feeling part of a community or whatever it turns out to be, but it's incredible.
Okay. Not too much football chat, please. People don't tune in for that. Now, more importantly, did you get any...
Thank you for the cross-promotion, though, but that's
any
good.
DMs about that friend you had on your face?
I did, actually. It's still there. It's gone down a fair bit. But, it's a sort of a long-term rental, it turns out to be. But I got a beautiful message from Danica. So Danica messaged me saying, "Hi, Corbs. Love the ABC Cricket Pod, especially twice weekly releases. Just started yesterday's and you mentioned your pimple. This is an old remedy. But have you tried toothpaste on it? Just plain toothpaste? Mm. Not a whitening one, as that will just burn your skin. Put it on before bed and it will dry up overnight. Have a great week." From Danica.
And?
I've tried everything and it's slowly going down. This one's very persistent. Mm-hmm. Probably doesn't help.
A bit of icicle always helps well.
Yeah, I've had the pimple patches. I've had a bit of everything.
Anyway, keep them rolling in. Any other feedback for the week?
I've got heaps, actually. Just a quick one from Dale. This is about mic technique, which a few of you might have noticed from time to time with our good friend Teddy. Can you please remind Eddie Cowan to talk into the mic? His voice wanders off regularly, and I have to turn the volume up. Not something I've noticed with anyone else in any podcast. Whatever his office/headphone setup is, it needs improvement. From
appreciate
Dale.
The feedback, Dale. I don't know many other podcasters that have to race from their lunch break to recording a podcast back to work, and here I am sitting with a $20 USB mic doing my best. Sometimes, as you know, Corb, I get very animated.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try and hold it a bit close to my face, but when I get animated, I get back and my arms start flailing around. People obviously don't see this, and I think my mouth obviously moves across. Anyway. Like all good feedback, it's a gift. I hear it.
Kurt says, "Hi, Corbin. Love your work. Should Australia look to..." Oh, this was actually... I alluded to Kurt's message last week, but I didn't read it out because I didn't have it handy. So I just wanted to flag that Kurt actually put this on the agenda for us before we even naturally fell into it last week. Should Australia look to introduce a separate selection panel for T20s going forward? I think this should allow for the selectors to have hard conversations with the test players and how they fit or do not fit in into the increasing specialist-driven T20 team. From Kurt. I think you asked me that last week, but I'm not sure you actually answered the question yourself, Teddy. Should they have a specialist T20 selection panel?
Well, I think I kind of got to an answer, and that is I wouldn't mind one selector, one independent T20 selector that works with the panel. But I still think you need the thread of a chairperson who is across all three formats, because there's going to be competing interests. They need to be aligned around certain availability. But someone who specifically only watches T20 cricket around the world, and maybe you're watching Chris Green, for instance, play in the West Indies League, as well as the Big Bash as well. So you're the global T20 kind of talent scout, because increasingly, if you don't think that in the next 5 years there will be an Australian T20 cricketer that doesn't touch the Australian domestic season, you're probably wrong.
Yeah.
I think there will be players that go from Aussie 19s to the CPL, for instance, and that's their way through the Australian setup.
Yeah.
That is not a pipe dream, by the way. It's probably on the next 2 years, but it is where the future's going. We're in a pretty liquid player market.
Which is what happens in, you know, association football and basketball, for example, where, you know, players drift overseas and then, yeah, the next time we really see them up in lights is in national colours. Josh says, can we expect a pub recording in Melbourne in future?
Oh, I would love that. I would love, maybe we should do the season finale in Melbourne.
Hey, okay. I thought this was a bit like the WWE. It just never shut down and just rolls week into week.
I'm not going to lie. I'm going to need a break.
We might have to write you off the show for a while, and then you can make a big return with a big pyro and everything. Like in the wrestling.
That'd be amazing. I'm in on that. Do you have a pub in mind?
We got heaps of good pubs in Melbourne.
Is that right? Just ask anyone that lives in Melbourne.
Yes. Yeah. This is a great city. What's going on in your city?
I'm
going
to move here. Pubs and football. It's like, yeah, great, mate.
What's going on in your city, by the way? It was like Armageddon yesterday in Sydney. You guys are like Brisbane light now. You got the southeast Queensland weather that's rolled through. And Jonathan picked up your thread, by the way, from a few weeks ago when you were talking about the playing kits of the T20 teams. Jonathan simply just put Canada should have gone out in the whites. He was a big fan of that, with your suggestion that maybe that would have been the way to go. Mm-hmm. All right, we'll get into a little bit of our agenda here. That's, as I said the other day, incredibly, the T20 World Cup is continuing. Without us, we were hoping for a Zimbabwe push to go all the way through to the Final Four. They've already been eliminated. They're the first team knocked out of their group. South Africa have qualified. So South Africa 2-0, and then India hang in the tournament. They level up at 1-1. The West Indies also 1-1 in their group. So the two games overnight, Teddy. First of all, South Africa winning the toss, decided to field. They had the Windies on the ropes at 5-60. Somehow, the Caribbean boys made their way to 176. But wasn't nearly enough, as Aidan Markram made an unbeaten 82 and South Africa won by 9 wickets with 23 balls to spare. So they're humming at the moment, the Proteas.
Humming and in a very similar fashion to the last World Cup, where they played excellent cricket and fell at the last hurdle. So, yeah, I think we flagged South Africa as a team before the tournament as a team that shapes up very nicely, you know, from a style of play. Just to round that conversation out, because I didn't watch much of the game specifically, but obviously the West Indies now play India in what is effectively a quarterfinal. So whoever wins that fixture will go through. And in the other group, I know you'll get there, but England have qualified, and it looks as though New Zealand will qualify, and we'll talk about that more broadly. But you're going to end up with only probably, on the balance of probability, one subcontinental team out of four semi-finalists, despite it being played in India and Sri Lanka, and we talk about advantage, etc., while South Africa, England and New Zealand all playing good enough cricket, and maybe it's a sign that Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Afghanistan, Pakistan just aren't keeping up to speed, that, you know, conditions are less interesting or less in their favour, I guess, the shorter the format, and the other nations, you know, the power that they display across all facets is shining through.
Are the places all subtly different in a way that perhaps, you know, once upon a time we just looked at it and said, oh, it's the subcontinent. They'll be, you know, short boundaries and they'll spin, for example. Whereas it feels like, and now we're playing more cricket in Pakistan than we certainly did in the, you know, the previous decade, it feels like, yeah, Pakistan's very different to Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka's very different to India. Do you feel like we're appreciating that perhaps more now than we ever have?
I think that's always been the case. I think it's a lazy analysis to suggest otherwise. You know, in Test cricket as it is in shorter form, you know, we saw England the other day against Sri Lanka in Sri Lanka basically play three spinners and spin Sri Lanka out. Yeah. So, you know, sometimes the further east you get across the subcontinent, the more it turns. But it's not always the way. I think that kind of is a bit generic as well. It is very condition dependent, and you need, I guess, what it shows is ultimate flexibility and durability of your squad. And so England, three pretty good T20 spinners, but they've also got Archer, they've got some, you know, they've got some big pace, they've got people who swing the ball, and they've got great death and spinners, and so they've actually got some bases covered. And having jokingly ridden them off, you know, prior to the tournament, they're doing almost what we hoped Australia would do and build through the tournament, get better and play their best cricket at the back end. And they look like a pretty tricky team to beat. It looks as though they'll probably match up with India in the semi-final. So if they do go all the way, they're going to do it the hard way.
I'm glad you're coming around to England, by the way, too, Teddy, because I don't know if you remember, but at the start of the World Cup, I did flag that I think they'd be a potential semi-finalist and that they got a nice unit and that they could run deep, which is why this matchup's beautiful, because we did say, look, outside of Australia and India, if you had to pick a team, you said you'd go with New Zealand. I said I'd go with England, and here they are about to play each other coming up tonight. So, yeah, as you said, New Zealand's in the box seat, even if they lose tonight, because they've got such a superior net run rate. So even if Pakistan beat Sri Lanka, which isn't a given, yeah, Pakistan would have to make up like a ridiculous amount of net run rate to essentially leapfrog them into that position. It does raise an interesting question, as you touched on. You know, say England finished top of the group, which is right there for them. They would play India, who are likely to finish second in their group with a win over the West Indies. Would you rather finish one and play India or finish two and play South Africa? What's a better result, do you think?
I think finishing two and playing South Africa. India in a home semi-final in a World Cup is not that enticing, I wouldn't have thought. I mean, there is a world. The West Indies turn it on. That effectively, as I said, is a quarter-final, and they need one day out. You need two players to play match-winning innings.
Yep.
And India can be gone from this tournament. Mm-hmm. And that really would shake things up.
They were incredible last night. So they took 80 off their last five overs, ended up with 256. This is a proper sort of IPL score that India were able to get to. It was their highest T20 international score. They reached the previous mark with two overs to spare, so they went well past it. Hardik Pandya with a blazing half century at the back end. They won by 72 runs. And Zimbabwe actually, it looked like a reasonable score. You make 180 odd and still lose by 70 runs. And Brian Bennett, who we flagged with X a few weeks ago and gave you a little bit of the back of his baseball card and his story as a young star of Zimbabwean cricket, but 97 not out. He carried his bat through the innings, fell just short of three figures there. So India with a monstrous win over Zimbabwe. So Sri Lanka eliminated, Zimbabwe eliminated, as you perfectly set it up, Teddy, a virtual quarterfinal between the West Indies and India to see who joins South Africa in the final four from that group. And in the other group, New Zealand the favoured way, even with a loss. Pakistan would have to make up significant net run rate with a win over Sri Lanka, who have already been...
Is it mathematically possible? Is it even? I mean, their net run rate's three or something. So I don't actually...
Pakistan's negative 0.461 and New Zealand's plus three.
So how... In maybe it's a question for Rick Finlay. To me, that says like they need to win in five overs or something. Like, it's beyond the realms of possibility.
Yeah. Who wins out of England and New Zealand?
Toss the coin. Don't know.
Do you like Harry Brook batting further up the order? Like,
absolutely. Yeah. Man, this guy is a superstar, and this is his format. Like, he's the modern-day Kevin Peterson, if Kevin Peterson doesn't get classed as modern-day. Mm. But you get my vibe. So he's got 360, he's got the spin covered, he's got the pace covered, he can hit it out of the park from ball one. As many balls as possible, please, Harry.
Played it beautifully the other night. So we'll chat again before the semi-final stage. Obviously, we'll be back on Monday. So semis next week are essentially Wednesday, Thursday, midnight. Not friendly times for these semi-finals. And then the final is as you go to bed on Sunday night, sort of 12:30, early hours of what is technically Monday morning. Mm-hmm.
Set the alarm call. Yes. You'll love that.
Yes. It's going to be a late night or an early morning, whichever way you chop it up. The women's series, you've been following along here, I know, Teddy. So 6-wicket win for the Aussies in the first ODI in Brisbane. So they level the multi-format series. Alisa Healy returned, obviously, to have her farewell swing. She's playing the three ODIs and the test match. She's not keeping, though, so Beth Mooney keeps the gloves. It was interesting to see her run around barehanded in the outfield. 76 for Mooney as well, and the Aussies chased the target with 10 overs to spare. So their winning record at Ellen Border Field extends to 21-0. They don't lose too many 50-over games, period. And then Elise Perry and Kim Garth both missing the match with quad injuries. So the Aussies get it back on level pegging with two games to come at the Bellerive Oval. Their ODIs this weekend, Friday, Sunday, and then the test match, which is over in Perth, March 6-9.
We love a women's test match in Perth. Mm. You talk about Alisa Healy coming back into the team, not keeping, but captaining.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of interesting to my mind, having lost the T20 series with a new captain in Sophie Molyneux, then Healy comes back, and maybe I'm reading into this too much, but you know, that they get back into the winning habit and doing so convincingly with a change of skipper. So it is a bit of a watch. We talked about it a few weeks ago. You know, Healy's always going to be, or was always, a lock in the team, has been a great captain. When you start having captains that aren't necessarily locks in the team from a selection point of view,
mm-hmm.
and they start losing games, that's when pressure mounts and change eventually happens. So I think, not that it's on the precipice after one series, but I've definitely got a little monocle out just to put that in the firing line a little bit.
No doubt. It's a live series, so it feels like it's going to go down to that test match in Perth one way or the other now. So I think even if...
Alisa captaining in Perth?
Yep.
For the test match?
Yeah, okay. She'll captain the rest of the way.
That's what I thought. Okay. Mm.
So three matches to go. You'll hear them all, of course, through ABC Listen and on ABC Sport. The article in the Guardian, I don't know if you saw this, around the 100, it's been a huge conversation piece, obviously in UK cricket, but Barney Ronay's article where he talks about the England and Wales cricket board jeopardising its integrity by allowing the Indian Premier League investors to take control of the 100, creating a moral and legal minefield, was the quote. The influx of Indian ownership raises concerns about the potential exclusion of Pakistani players, which could breach UK anti-discrimination laws. Now, you can imagine the ECB's come out very quickly and said, nope, that won't be the case. You know, Pakistan players will be eligible to be drafted and so on and so forth. The auction will take place in about 14 days' time, so it's about 2 weeks from today.
Yeah, I did say it. Interesting article, and you know the flow on is to keep a watch on this as to how that could potentially pan out if Big Bash teams were sold to IPL owners. And so, you know, there are a couple of talking points here. One is specifically as it relates to the ECB. I don't know for fact, but I think it is a very high probability that no Pakistani players get drafted to any teams that are owned by IPL teams.
Not one.
Not one.
Wow.
Well, they're majority owners. They have a final say. I think that we've seen in the past the intertwining of, you know, the political nature of the BCCI and the government. And so I just can't see that happening. Of course, not every team is owned by IPL teams. And so I think we'll see Pakistani players in the 100. And so I think this kind of story goes away to a degree, but it does open up a very interesting legal can of worms, as Barney kind of alludes to, of how could you actually prove,
you know,
discrimination based on race, essentially. And that could be tricky. But it is, you know, for a country that the middle class is increasingly South Asian, they're, you know, to exclude a large portion of that society when you're pitching, you know, T20 as the new form of cricket that is going to take English cricket to new markets and new eyes. You know, your core eyes already are probably South Asian in many respects, and you're alienating, you know, a large portion of that, particularly through the Midlands in Birmingham and the like. So it's a really interesting watch. And then, you know, the flow-on question is around what would be the implication if Big Bash teams got sold. How would you feel as a supporter? Let's say an IPL team bought your beloved Melbourne Renegades.
Yes, yeah.
And that meant that no Pakistani players would ever play for the Renegades again. Mm. As a Australian with a sense of fairness, a sense of justice,
yeah. And
that is a written kind of code of conduct as to how what the club stands for. How would you feel about that, being a fan?
Yeah. Oh, it's no doubt it wouldn't sit well with you. I mean, the thing we love about sport, really, at the end of the day, is we love to believe it's this meritocracy, don't we? That at the end of the day, doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, who your parents are, whatever the case turns out to be. You know, if you can't hit the ball at 150 kilometres an hour, you're not playing, for example. Like, it's that simple. But I mean, not to be too cynical, and what we should always do, particularly on podcasts like this, and us as the press and the Fifth Estate and everything else, is always appeal to our better angels and, you know, all the rest of it, and call out when this kind of stuff goes on. There would be people out there, though, even in Australian sport, that would be saying, hey, this is just a problem that's hiding in plain sight. We all know the political nature around it and, you know, the bans that have been put on Pakistani players in the IPL and so on and so forth. But You know, Usman Khawaja retired recently and basically said, hey, you know, this was my experience coming through the ranks of Australian cricket, for example. There would be players of South Asian backgrounds or people of colour or whatever it turns out to be, you know, playing lower levels of cricket, feeling like, hey, I didn't get selected for that team. And I felt like, you know, my performances outweighed that guy. And yet that guy looked different than me and he got the opportunity and I didn't. Like, you could argue that this happens in sport all the time. And, you know, when it comes down to marginal calls, for example, and that's where, you know, in this kind of situation, as yeah, as brutal it is for the Pakistan players, you know, ultimately, yeah, unless they're absolute world beaters, and you sort of look through that team at the moment and you go, look, who's the guy that if it's a 50-50 call, do we take the Pakistani player or do we take the other guy? You know, you can understand with all the political tension and the backdrop and everything that goes into it that, you know, owners will more than likely lean against the Pakistani player. And I don't know whether it's so explicit in this case, but I don't know whether it's absolutely, you know, unique or never before seen in the history of sport.
Yeah, but perhaps. But I think the difference being is maybe a subconscious bias as opposed to a very clear, maybe it's not explicit, but it certainly feels that way, bias against a group of players. And so I would hate it, to be honest.
No doubt.
IPL owners had big bash teams and were excluding players based on nationality. I think that does not sit comfortably with me one iota.
Yep.
Not for a second.
I'll tell you what, I mean, whether it's this story or stories that we've heard, and the more we learn about it, and we keep hearing from Todd Greenberg that, you know, this is going to be a decision made in the first quarter of 2026 about private ownership. The whole thing's just got a real whiff about it, doesn't it? Like, it feels like there's so many things that need to be ironed out before we get to that point. And the clock's ticking. I feel like there's a rush.
I don't understand if that's where you feel like it's at. I'm sure other
stakeholders feel that way.
I know the ACA feel that way. Certainly, you know, there's a lot to work through. And so you can't force timelines in any kind of transaction. I understand sometimes you need a finish line to push people along.
Yep.
But when you're talking about probably the biggest decision Australian cricket would have made of the last 50 years, maybe longer, I think you want all the information on the table.
The more I think about it, and again, I don't know as much about this space as you and so many other people, that just feels like to me that the league has to be siphoned off first, doesn't it? Like, if we're going to do it, privatise the league. And I know you said, you go back to one of our early podcasts and you spoke about, you know, all of this. And
July 2025.
Yeah, you can put equity in the league and everything. Like, I don't know. The one model that I feel like's got whiskers all over it is, oh, let's sell two of the teams and then everyone else kind of continues on. I don't know how that's going to work. But it's a sad, you know, sign of the times, this story out of the 100. And yeah, it feels like, unfortunately, as we sort of move forward, the political tensions are, you know, getting hotter. They're not calming down.
So something on my mind that's slightly adjacent to the topic but is certainly related is, you know, part of the pitch from those that are pro-privatisation is this strategic element of having a IPL owner own a team, because there's this multi-club strategy that, you know, for instance, the Mumbai Indians are running. So they own the New York Indians, the Oval in the 100 are being renamed, the London Indians or whatever it is, they own a team in the SA20, the Cape Town team, and they also obviously own the Mumbai Indians. So they're signing players up on global deals, global franchise deals, and increasingly they will ask a Pat Cummins or a Marcus Stoinis or a Travis Head, hey, we're going to pay you more just to play around the world T20. And strategically, we need them inside the tent rather than pissing from the outside, if I can say that on a podcast. But you get the idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, where my mind goes is that falls over a little bit, because if Devolt Brevis, who's already signed the T20, you know, we don't get the benefit of those players playing in our league because they already own teams in other leagues that are competing for time when we're playing our league. So it's only really protecting our players. And so I think there are other ways to ensure our best players continually play in Australia, unless we can get the benefit of the other players playing in Australia, which I don't think is actually going to happen under their current multi-club. Maybe occasionally, maybe for a few games, but if you're trying to build brand equity, you need those players for the whole season, you need them committed, and unfortunately they're pre-committed elsewhere.
There's a lot to work through. And it's a bit rich too, isn't it? As much as I think all of us, we grew up in a very different culture, you know, we we probably don't, or we certainly don't understand the tensions between the two countries, between India and Pakistan, as deeply. Just back to on that and talking about, you know, the IPL involvement and everything else. But it's a bit rich, isn't it, to come in and say, hey, we want all your money, but we also want to do it our way, operate under the way that we do it, and we don't want any of your politics essentially attached to it. Like, you can't have it every which way, can you?
No.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I know, if you have control of the teams, you have control of the teams.
Yeah.
And so once you lose control, it's very hard to to manage that.
It's an interesting watch. And this is, I mean, we even the PIF and the amount of money they're putting into sport and how it impacts, you know, various other competitions. And when it gets to a certain point where, you know, if they want to do things a certain way and that's where the money's coming from, what happens then? You know, the people stand up and say, hey, no, I'm not co-signing that, while they've already taken the millions of dollars, or are they going to leave them on the table to, you know, stand on their principle or whatever it turns out to be? On other matters, so the BBL, Teddy, Trevor Bayliss, no longer the coach of the Sydney Thunder, so club got their sixth wooden spoon, so it means that both the Sydney teams are looking for a new senior coach. Mm-hmm. Question for you in your role with your multiple hats, does this knock on to what happens with Cricket New South Wales? I know as much as, you know, the Sixers and the Thunder appoint their own coach, does it impact with, say, a multi-deal if you're looking for a new coach, for example, and you say, hey, not only can you coach a one-day cup and a shield team, but, you know, here's one of the big bash teams, for example, to coach as well.
Yeah, I'll take a step back and not necessarily use the New South Wales example specifically, but I will answer the question. The coaching market is very tight. And so what do coaches like doing at the moment? They like coaching these T20 leagues because, you know, there's still accountability, but generally they get well paid and they're for short stints. They still get good time with their family. Unfortunately, almost the worst job in world cricket, it used to be an absolute crowning, you know, a real crown jewel of a job, is any state-based role.
Yep.
And so as you kind of alluded to, the best way to attract the best coaches is to bundle deals. And so whether it was Greg Shipard, Sixers in New South Wales, Adam Burgess, you kind of get the idea. But they are very hard to find now. You know, someone who wants to coach essentially for 9 months of the year, takes all flexibility out. They need to be based in one place. You know, they might have other commitments.
Pardon? A lot of,
what do you mean?
They need to be based in one place.
Well, they do, as in one kind, you know.
Yeah.
Didn't the, you kind of get my point.
I'm not sure the previous coach was based in Sydney, was he?
I think you'd be surprised as to how much time he spent here. He might have been a Victorian resident officially,
sure.
But if you're coaching a state team, you're not FIFO. And so where do you get to? I think, you know, what other states have done well is they invest in a local state coach, you know, an up-and-coming, potentially unproven coach,
mm-hmm.
and then you get your headline in for the you know, the big profile T20 job. So in my mind, there will be no shortage of people who are queuing up for that T20 role across the Thunder or the Sixers, and they'll probably put the hand up for both. Yeah. And there are probably six or seven names that come to mind who have coached, you know, franchises around the world and now want to come back and, well, they might not even be Australian. It appeals to international coaches as well. But it would be a surprise to me to have someone who wanted to coach the state team who wasn't based in Sydney. And that's a pretty small pool.
So the people that are looking, so you're obviously the board, so at the end of the day, and the cricket director, so you obviously sign off on any signature, whoever it turns out to be, is the Cricket New South Wales coach. Do you do the same thing for the Sixers and the Thunder?
We do, yeah.
Yep. Sweet.
We do. But you got to remember, a board member's role is not to appoint coaches or fire coaches. Yeah. It's to make sure the process around that is strong and to ask questions. And, you know, it's the general manager's job in the T20 sense to appoint the coach, and in many respects it's the head of cricket and the CEO's job to get a New South Wales coach.
So I guess if you were looking for one of these bundle deals, and again, if you're, you know, who's the GM at the Sixers at the moment? Excuse my ignorance.
Rachel Haynes.
Australia's, Rachel Haynes, of course. She took over from
finest, you know,
from Jody, of course.
Great operator.
Yeah. Yep. So if you're Rachel Haynes and you're Trent Copeland, is this like almost like a race in the sense to get to Legion on as quick as possible and say, hey, Lee, let's do this and we can get this person based in Sydney? Like, I guess that was my question. Like, Shipard was obviously with the Sixers, but what's to stop Trent Copeland and the Thunder doing the same thing essentially? Nothing.
Well, nothing, but I think what will happen is you stage it and you say, here's the short list of the New South Wales coaches. Here's the long list of the T20 coaches. You've got more time. The state program starts in 3 months' time, essentially. The T20 programs, you know, by the time the draft and whatever, the lists are pretty settled, is a bit further down the track. So, you know, the focus definitely would be on getting the New South Wales coach, and then the flow-through effect is who coaches the T20 teams from there.
Yeah. Wow.
But it is a very unique situation. Yeah. Maybe definitely needing two coaches, maybe needing three.
Mm. Is it a nice farewell, or is it more awkward if Greg Shepherd wins the title on the way out in the One Day Cup?
Well, I think that'd be what a great,
yep,
great way to sign off.
Yeah. The only in part of his
and a testament to him that the team is playing well.
Yeah. In his departure, though, it did say that he wasn't winning trophies, and that was part of it. And then he wins a trophy, and you think, well, maybe if he'd let it run its course, would the decision be different as opposed to making the decision at the time that they did?
Yep. Valid questions.
It's just on that One Day Cup final, by the way. It's meant to be played this weekend. It's not, because there's a bit of a domino effect here. So Junction Oval Lights aren't ready. So one of their games goes to Hobart. So Hobart picks up a doubleheader. They now play the women's ODIs Friday and Sunday. The One Day Cup game was meant to be played on the Saturday. So otherwise there would be 300 overs, essentially, of cricket played at the Junction Oval on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. They've decided against that. They couldn't find an alternate venue. So as a result, it's been moved to March 11. Which leaves us in this position, Teddy, where there was games last weekend, and now there's been no cricket all week, and there's no cricket at all until not next week or next Thursday when the Sheffield Shield returns. So in what should be, you know, our season, in the cricket season still, right when the footy's gearing up, we're not playing any domestic cricket whatsoever.
Don't like it.
Neither do I.
I don't like it.
What should they have done as an alternative? You can't really move the Shield around forward, can you, on short notice?
You can't on short notice, not around bowling loads, etc. I think...
Should Tassie have been forced to play their game somewhere else?
Well, they could have taken it to Launceston. Imagine if they had another stadium down the road. Who would have thought? I would have moved the women's ODI elsewhere.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Rather than taking it to Hobart.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, it depends on how many people would have been putting their hand up at the short notice. The other thing is TV crews and whatever it turns out to be. Like, if you move it to...
It's easier for them, for sure. They're having a lovely long weekend down in Hobart. They might sneak some golf in at 7 Mile Beach, for sure.
But if you had to move...
Broadcasts are happy.
Yeah. If you had to move everything, though, from, like, Saturday morning for a Sunday start down to Hobart, that's hard to do from Adelaide or Canberra or whatever, as opposed to doing it from Melbourne.
So, I agree with that. Yeah. Sure. Maybe my comments are redundant. I hadn't really thought it through, to be honest.
It's not it's whatever it is, it's not an ideal scenario. I mean, remembering back in the day when the Vics didn't have an appropriate venue, they had to play Shield finals in Alice Springs and also at Bellary Oval. Maybe they should have said to Tassie, hey, too bad, it's going to a neutral venue. It's now at...
I think that's a reasonable
Oval,
point
whatever
of view.
It turns out
for sure.
To be.
For sure.
Could have played it in Melbourne this weekend. Would have been a day game because the lights aren't ready, but there you go.
Yeah.
Marcus Harris set to return to competitive cricket this weekend following back surgery. So he's got a deal with Lancashire till the end of 2027. So got the back right when the Big Bash came. He's going to return in perfect time for Victoria with obviously the team already qualifying for the Shield final. He's going to play for St Kilda in Victoria Premier Cricket this weekend on his return. And then Thursday's fixture, Victoria up against Tasmania at the Bellrave Oval. You think he would come into contention then as well? Should he get through it okay? So good luck to Marcus Harris. I was always a big push for this, to have one weekend every year, and maybe it's just by chance that it's going to turn out this way where everybody goes back and plays grade cricket. It'd be like the perfect thing to do, say, in October. I know the schedules are so crowded and everything else, but imagine going to your local ground and watching, you know, Josh Hazlewood send him down or whatever it turns out to be. It'd be awesome.
A lot.
Yeah.
Some of my best memories of club cricket were Stu Clark bowling to Phil Jakes, you know, current test players, not just domestic professional players. We're talking about people who are some of the best players in the world at the time playing against each other.
One of my first roles in the media was covering grade cricket every Saturday for community radio. Teddy, I used to run down there on Sport FM and do the updates on the hour and call a bit of grade cricket. As you can imagine, there'd be plenty of people thirsty for some Joondalup versus Scarborough content on the Saturday afternoon or whatever it turned out to be. But I also picked up, as I was trying to broaden my horizons, a little column in the paper, which is your grade cricket column, which sits alongside the cricket scores on the Sunday. And you'd punch in there, this is what happened at this venue. And you'd ring around at the end of the day and put your column together. And one day I was out at Fremantle and Mitchell Johnson played. So Johnson's come over from Queensland. He's returning from injury, sending down these absolute thunderbolts, playing for Wanneroo. And so my little column, which is usually, you know, out the back near the racing results, ended up on the back page of the paper. Which
no
I was,
way. The photographer I thought it might have been down. Syndicated around the, awesome. Around the country.
No, I've still got it. So it's, yeah, there's my little column talking about how Mitchell Johnson bowled in his couple of spells. I think it was a one-day game. So, yeah, thanks, Mitch, for that. I appreciate it. It was what a
journalist at heart, not just a broadcaster.
Thomas got in touch with us, Teddy. He said, a couple of things for when scheduling chat inevitably comes up. I feel it's important to note that not only have we not played a test against Bangladesh since 2017, but there was meant to be a Bangladesh all-format tour in the 18-19 home summer, but Cricket Australia cancelled it for not being financially viable, despite having just signed the big deal with Fox Sports. The tour game is coming back for South Africa. In my opinion, South Africa and Australia has been the biggest rivalry in Test cricket of the 21st century. Only poor scheduling since 2018 has held it back. I wonder if Ed agrees or disagrees. From Thomas.
I don't think it's been the biggest Test rivalry of the 21st century, so I don't agree with that. What I do know is they're two great and proud Test cricket nations that have not invested heavily enough in playing each other.
What's been a bigger one? India or Australia?
India, Australia.
Mm. Yep,
some great test matches. No, you know, like, but in terms of, you know, we're talking about a country that actually doesn't play any test cricket at home.
Yeah.
So, you know, in their summer, so that gives you a sense of where they're at. They're an excellent team, world champions. I think we should play them more. They should be, but you know, economically, it's not really that sustainable. But we need to find ways to make it that way.
The schedule's out, by the way. So they're October test matches. First one's the 9th of October in Durban, then October 18 in Kabeja, which is the old Port Elizabeth, and then October 27 in Cape Town to finish. So how's that for some October cricket?
The footy season's done by then. I reckon we could push for a little live. Yeah. Should we do a live podcast in Cape Town?
That'd apparently? Be nice.
Beautiful be nice. In October. Nice.
This, and then the trade period, we can talk about that in between episodes and everything else. So be
yeah,
huge. Haven't been there for 8 years. And the Bangladesh tour, of course, which is in August. So August 13 and August 22 in Darwin and Mackay. Darwin held test matches back in 03 and 04. While Mackay is hosting Queensland's only test match this summer, of course, the Gabba misses out. They become the 12th test venue in Australia. So my quiz question for you, Teddy, on the way out, What are the other 11?
Okay. Do you want this live?
I want this live. This is raw and unedited.
Okay. So you have Darwin.
Yes.
So is that Marara?
Yes.
You have the Wacker.
Yep.
You have Optus.
Yep.
You have Adelaide Oval.
Yep. It's four.
You have the SCG. You have the MCG. You have Belrive Oval, Manuka Oval.
Eight.
You have Townsville.
Try again. What's the other one up there?
Oh, Cairns, sorry.
Cairns.
Nine. So I need 11.
Need
We've
two.
Got the Gabba. 10.
Yep. One to get.
Oh.
This is the one that'll. This is the reason the question exists.
Yeah, well, you should have. I mean, that's how you should have pitched it.
Yeah. So.
Is it a legacy test?
No, it's you won't get it. It's the Brisbane Exhibition Ground. So the Brisbane Exhibition Ground, known now as the Showgrounds. This is the read on Crick Info, Teddy, about the Brisbane Exhibition Ground. Had a short lifespan, staging only two tests and a couple of dozen first-class matches before being completely replaced by the Gabba. The venue was the home of the local agricultural shows, and remains to be, by the way. And when Brisbane was finally granted a test in 28-29, it was held at the Brisbane Exhibition Ground, as it was a natural amphitheatre and so could accommodate more people. However, revenue from that match and the test which followed in 30-31 was disappointing, largely because of the numbers who got in for free by using their agricultural society badges. As a result, the Queensland Cricket Association moved down the road to the Gabba. So the venue that Bill Ponsford once scored 100 at, and Don Bradman a double century, which doesn't narrow it down. That's most grounds that he played on around the world. But that's two test matches in the late 20s, early 30s, and that's it. One of the 11.
Great trivia.
Little history lesson for you on the way out. Thank you as always, Teddy. Have a great week. Weekend. I will chat to you on Monday.
Later, Corb.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.